Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. My name is Joe Tooman. I'm a professor of political and legal communications at San Francisco, and I've been here once or twice or 1,000 times, and I will be your moderator for today's program. Our guest tonight is political activist, writer, thinker, former politician, Tom Hayden, a former leader of the student civil rights, peace, and environmental movements of the 1960s and 1970s. He also served as 18 years, that's a long time, as a California state senator, where he chaired labor, higher education, and natural resources committees. As I mentioned, he's an author and teacher, and also the director of California's Peace and Justice Resource Center. His latest book, which, by the way, we were talking at the break, might be titled I Told You So, after President Obama's most recent decision, is actually called Listen, Yankee, Why Cuba Matters. And that's what brings him here today. In the wake of President Obama's move to reestablish diplomatic relations with Cuba, Tom's new book offers fresh and, I think, original insight, one of history's most enigmatic relationships between nation states. Listen, Yankee offers an account of Cuban politics where Hayden draws on his own past as a revolutionary student leader, whose efforts to mobilize political change in the United States mirrored simultaneous radical transformations going on inside Cuba as well. Tom puts the present moment into historical context, and in this book he shows us how we're finally finding common ground to the advantage of Cubans and Americans alike. Please join me in welcoming Tom Hayden.
Like being chairman of the Natural Resources Committee. What is this for, Joe? Thank you for coming. So happy to have an audience of this cross-section of people from San Francisco and from the Bay Area. This is the second time that I've made a presentation about this book, last night in Berkeley. Was the first, and it comes at a timely moment, according to my publisher. I was nagging at him to get the book out because I wrote it starting in 2013 on the premise that the U.S. and Cuba would normalize relations before Obama left office and Raul Castro left office. No one, including my publisher above all, believed me. After I had a dark night of the soul in the middle of writing it when I thought maybe I was wrong. Those are tough moments. And then it happened as I thought it would, and my publisher called up and said, "You were right." I said, "I told you, now what are we going to do?" So I had to rewrite the first 50 pages of the book, which reads as if they were written on December 18th, the day after the agreement was announced, and that's precisely when they were written. So I hope that the book flows smoothly, and it can be approached on a couple of levels. I'm best in easing into this as a conversation rather than a speech, but I know that I have to frame it a little bit. So the two approaches one could take to it. First, I try to emphasize what's in the news, and I'm sure that's what interests you most. What is this December 17th, 2014 agreement actually mean? What does it say? And how will it be carried out? And now how easy will it be for you to go to Cuba? How many of you have been in Cuba? Yeah, most Americans really, really obey that embargo stuff, don't they? So that's important. It's probably more important than ever. It's the most important thing that's happened in a very, very long time. In many ways. The background story is where the book began, though. I partnered on this book with a Cuban leader named Ricardo Alarcón, who who, like myself, was a graduate student in philosophy. He at the University of Havana and I at the University of Michigan back in the day. And he was in the underground movement that overthrew the Batista dictatorship and became a member of the diplomatic corps, the youngest diplomat in the United Nations in the early 60s, and went on to be the foreign minister of Cuba, the UN representative of Cuba, and was brought home to be president of the National Assembly, which is like the parliament of Cuba, before retiring about the time that this book was being conceived. And so I was invited by Ricardo Alarcón in 2006 to go to Cuba because he wanted to interview me about the American New Left and its relationship to Cuba and what had happened for the Cuban historical archives. And we spent many hours in discussions. And then in about 2013, he wanted me to come back. So first it was 2006 and 2013. And I went curious. But he wanted to resume conversations about the history of the relationship and what had happened. And I asked his daughter, who's a kind of a bilingual, binational, bicultural woman who's Cuban, of course, but who's lived so long in New York when he was at the UN, what was this about? I mean, he was a very busy man, and she said, nothing, just two old guys talking. And that gave me the chapter heading I was looking for. Because I think of revolution and life as being integrated, and there's a birth phase and there's an ending phase. And when you're in the ending phase, whether it's a revolution or simply the life of a human, you look back to try to evaluate what happened. What did it look like when you were a young person? Did it turn out that way? What lessons are to be drawn? You have a chance at wisdom, a final chance at wisdom, perhaps. And so that was the book I was writing about the history of life and the history of the Cuban Revolution as experienced by Cubans and by North Americans who were deeply caught up one way or another in this process. And I interviewed many old revolutionaries. I interviewed people from intelligence services. I interviewed people who were White House national security advisors. And I tried to develop this composite story of Cuba and the United States from the 19th century forward until this moment when the so-called milagro, the miracle happened on December 17th when suddenly Americans and Cubans saw on television without announcement Barack Obama and Raul Castro announcing that they were recognizing each other. So the backstory interests me more, and I have a sense you might be more interested in that. But let's start very briefly with where things are now, because we're in a new phase, a new beginning. The past is not entirely past. But what happened was an agreement that was carefully crafted over about a two-year period, during which time I came to have a certain ironic respect for secrecy in government. Because no one would talk to anyone about anything, which made it hard to nail the story down. And they were very successful in both countries in keeping everyone from knowing anything. And yet that made it very difficult for me to say, this is happening, believe me, when there was absolutely no corroborating evidence that anything was happening except discussions. But without the secrecy, it may not have happened. The history of this relationship, which is tormented, includes a lot of derailings of hopeful processes because somebody finds out, and there are plenty of people who want to stop it, who want to sabotage it, who want to prevent it. And this could have happened at any moment. So that's what I faced. You know, on the left, there's a feeling that imperialism itself doesn't change its character, and therefore the United States will never, ever recognize Cuba. So why was I deluding myself? On the right, there was a imperial triumphalism represented by the Diaz-Balarts and the Rubios and the Menendez and the people in Congress who thought that they had learned how to get a political monopoly on the policy so that they could prevent any president, Democrat or Republican, from ever normalizing relations until the Castros were dead or overthrown, or preferably both at once. And so there was this dogmatic certainty that nothing could happen. And one thing I've learned in the last 55 years is that no one can ever predict anything. It makes people extremely insecure because they want what we used to call a perspective, an analysis of objective conditions and all that. But there are surprises built into history. So this was sudden, and it did not end the embargo, but it pretty much destroyed the embargo. What's left of the embargo, which was signed into law by Bill Clinton and can't be ended or terminated without an act of this Republican Congress, what's left of it is a prohibition on your going to Cuba as a tourist. Oh, what a disaster, what a burden. I see all of you slumping over. Oh, no. So Jeff Flake, a Republican senator from Arizona, will be carrying a bill requiring the lifting of the ban on tourism. And we'll just see what happens with that. In the meanwhile, the embargo is going to be hollowed out significantly from within, because pretty soon you should be able to use credit cards and travel in many, many categories to Cuba and spend money, and therefore there'll be a revenue flow, remittances from Americans who are there, as long as they're not classified as tourists. So in that sense, the embargo will be eroded fundamentally. The president is expected to lift the ban on Cuba as a terrorist state sometime this spring. He has the executive power to do that, although two-thirds of the Senate could reverse it. That would mean that Cuba would be eligible for this really subversive opportunity to get capitalist loans from international financial institutions, which would mean a source of money for a country that is starved of money. In early April, the countries of the region will meet in Panama, where Raul Castro and Barack Obama will sit at a conference together, will shake hands, will make some kind of remarks, and will be complimented by one and all from Central and Latin America to consolidate the fact that there's huge, huge sympathy for this reconciliation or this recognition from all of Latin America. And that will give Cuba comfort that it has a balance against the United States, and it gives Obama the ability to say that this step forward opens the door to better relations in a region that's generally hostile to us because of our 55 years of failed policies towards Cuba. All of these things remain to be done. And in the meantime, there are talks going on, business-like talks, over a lot of the practical problems of reconstructing a shattered relationship. Embassies will be opened. The Republicans will try to defund the embassy. An ambassador will be appointed. The Republicans will try to cut the salary of the ambassador, but life will go on. Another 100,000 of you will go to Cuba this year, if not more. 1 million Canadians will again go to Cuba. 1 million Europeans will again go to Cuba. The Obamas will go to Cuba. Some people on the left say, oh my God, they're going to be smothered in McDonald's. And then the same people will say, can I have a latte double, please? And the right wing will say the dictatorship will be supported by American dollars. And the fact of the matter is a conflict that has been very destructive is being gradually healed and resolved. And it will not be easy. And when you're resolving a conflict, it's not really proper to declare victory or defeat. That's rubbing your adversary's face. So neither of them can quite say it. But let me say this is a victory for the Cuban Revolution in the sense that the United States has attempted by all manner foul and fair to destroy the Cuban government, the Castro leadership, the Cuban Revolution, the Cuban example, from the earth since the early 1960s with a vengeance that is hard to for us to embrace or understand. And it's failed. Everything has failed, and Barack Obama has become the first American president to recognize the government of Cuba as determined by the Cuban Revolution and the Cuban people. So it is a victory that we shouldn't cheer about, apparently, but I take great satisfaction in that this small country of 11 or 12 million people has withstood so much for the simple principle of non-interference in their affairs, the simplest of all principles on which our country was founded. That doesn't mean that the revolution will go on in a discernible manner, predictable manner. They will fight to maintain their core government programs, free health care, higher education, their international missions, their doctors, medical personnel on the front lines of the battle against Ebola. They won't give that up. And they'll try to stand with Latin America for the concept of the New Deal, at least, of a very strong government that protects the infirm and sets guidelines and incentives for the direction of the economy. On the other hand, there will be a private sector. There is a private sector. McDonald's probably will be there. Private companies will spring up, are springing up. Entrepreneurs will spring up. And as my colleague, Mr. Alarcón, said that he'd been studying all his life, and he never found anything in Marx or Lenin that required the state to own restaurants and barbershops. And so it will happen. There will be inequalities as a result of this because capitalism brings inequalities. There will be racial disparities that have to be dealt with, that have to be dealt with by the Cuban government, by the Cuban people, without American interference. But in a sense, there could be a benign American interference. The very fact that we have an African-American president and that he'll vacation there will have a deep effect on race relations in Cuba. They can learn from the LGBT movements, the civil rights movements here, but it has to be based on a listening and a mutual respect and equality. That's the title of the book, Listen Yankee, which I'll get into in a moment. We don't listen very well. People who are the heads of the households don't listen People who are the heads of state don't listen. People who think they're the superpower have a very difficult time taking anybody else as an equal and listening to what they say. But if you want to influence Cuba, it requires listening to Cuba. And they're eager to listen to us, but not with weapons pointed at them, not with spies and subversives. Listen, Yankee, is what it's always been about. It's the title of a book that both Ricardo Alarcón and I deeply admired when it was published in 1960 by an American sociologist named C. Wright Mills, who was a maverick. He was a hell of a sociologist, too. He did his interviews with primary sources. He had an encyclopedic mind. He devoured all the research there was on a subject. He got very interested in Cuba. He went to Cuba for 3 weeks and stayed up 18 hours a day interviewing people like Fidel Castro and wrote a book that was a bestseller by this name, Listen, Yankee. It was like a manifesto, and it was shocking in its comprehensiveness at the time. He said it was the voice of a Cuban revolutionary. I pretty much think it was the voice of Fidel Castro riding in a jeep next to him as he made his way around the island. But it's the authentic voice, a composite voice of the Cubans that he met with. And it forecast much of what had happened, that they were a middle-class revolution. They knew that that was new, a student-led revolution. They knew that that was new, but that was similar to us in Madison, Ann Arbor, San Francisco, Berkeley. We were students. We were very young, very, very young. And we had to reach the rest of the population, in that case, the peasantry and what there was of a working class. And they had to wage a battle, underground battle, that could only be resolved by some sort of insurrection, since all of the political channels had been closed. Fidel had actually run for Congress the year before he embarked on this quest. He drove something like 50,000 miles around the island in a Chevrolet, shaking hands. And then he went into the mountains and took up the gun because the elections were closed down. So Listen, Yankee was very important to Ricardo Alarcón and myself. Ricardo Alarcón actually wrote several articles later in life about how important Mills was. One was a very poignant article that I cite in this book, or a quotation, where he said, "We're still waiting for him to come back." Mills had planned to write a longer book and come back. He was having gradual heart failure and eruptions, partly because of the pressure he was under. The Cuban doctors wanted him to come to Cuba. They wanted to treat him. He never made it. He died of a massive heart attack in early 1962 when he was about to debate A.A. Burleigh on Latin American policy. And so he's a missing character in the book. He's also very important because a young person who lived most of his life in San Francisco, Saul Landau. How many knew Saul? I died just before this book was finished. And Saul was the interpreter for Mills in Cuba with Fidel in 1960. Spent his whole life devoted to explaining, understanding, and writing about the Cuban Revolution with its ups and downs. So we began these conversations about the past and what it was like when we were young men, and realized that the first phase is romanticism and idealism, and it's all about the insurgent feeling of love, the spilling in all directions, and on the personal and on the political levels. He met his girlfriend, his compañera, his future wife, Margarita, in the student movement, actually, in the revolution. And they were together all the time, and they had a child. They lived in New in New York. They lived in Havana. They were quite a pair. And then after the early phase of love and inspiration, there come unexpected developments. You have power to do great things or make mistakes. Power gets old. The unexpected happens. She became a victim of Parkinson's, the youngest that the Cuban medical practitioners had ever seen. She lived with Parkinson's for a long time. He would often negotiate secretly with Americans on the phone from her bed in the hospital in Havana, even during the Elian Gonzalez crisis in Florida. That was not expected at the beginning of the Cuban Revolution, in life or in love or in politics. So you go through these phases, and then the final phase, of course, is if you have the opportunity to look back and to make a judgment about where we are today. The Cuban people are now entering a new chapter of what Jose Martí called the vast and beautiful space of our America. Thank you.
Well, before I do anything, let me also say for our radio audience, this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're talking to political activist. He's more than that, my goodness. Author, thinker, intellectual, and former politician, Tom Hayden, about his new book, Listen, Yankee, Why Cuba Matters. My name is Joe Tooman. I'm a professor of political and legal communications at San Francisco State, and tonight I'm your moderator. I'd like to open with a couple of questions to sort of start us off on this, maybe to extend off what we were talking about before the program, Tom, if we may. And let me start with the question that you get into. You address this subject pretty early in the book about the influence of Cuban exile families, notably in Florida and in some other states as well, thank you, who seem to have, over the last almost half a century, had an extraordinary influence on U.S. foreign policy in preventing what we're seeing now happening before. Now, I would guess that some of that influence owes in states like Florida to the fact that if you're a Republican running for the nomination, you have to be able to win in the primaries in the South. That's a southern state. And so you have to adopt positions that won't antagonize some of these people. My first question to you, we talked about before, I'd like you to tease out for the audience. How are things different now with those families? And as a secondary question, I'll throw you a curveball. Will this be an issue, in your judgment, a campaign issue in the 2016 election as well?
The people that fought and lost at the Bay of Pigs in 1961 are now either dead or passing. They're octogenarians. They're 80. They are bitter, for the most part, anti-Castro, anti-communist, and vengeful, but they live in an emotional atmosphere that is not necessarily shared by their children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. And even some of them now want to go back. Some of them who accept the fact that the revolution has happened, that the government is not going to be overthrown, that they're not going to march back into Havana and reclaim their plantations or whatever they lost. So they accept it. And then other instincts set in over time. One is to see your homeland, to see where your great-grandparents are buried, to see where all these battles were fought, you know, to return to a house, to go to the beach. And so there's a propensity in favor of normalization that is more powerful than anti-communism among the Cubans in Florida and New Jersey. And when you get down to the 40-year-olds, it's overwhelming because they've heard about this place. And last year alone, there were 400 or more thousand people of Cuban descent who went to Cuba from Florida and from Jersey. 400,000. They didn't go down there to assassinate the leadership. I don't know why they went down. There was a mixture of all these reasons. And the younger ones voted for Obama in 2008. They voted for Obama in 2012. So the answer to your question on second question is that a Hillary Clinton-type candidate would win their vote in Florida, although I don't know if she would win against Jeb Bush.
Okay.
The diaspora has changed.
I'm going to conjoin three questions from audience members and ask you to sort of comment on it. Can you speak today to the role of women in the Cuban Revolution and women today? And as well, a question, is that revolution or the spirit of the revolution still active and alive with young people? And I don't mean those who are being groomed for leadership, but young people in Cuba. And how would you comment in contrasting that with the American left today, since that's kind of what this book is about, the contrast of the two?
That's above my pay grade. There's a gradual increase in the quantitative measures in terms of women in government, women in parliament. Compares favorably, certainly, with the United States. But it's by no means parity of esteem. There's a resurgence of interest in the role of Aide Santa Maria and Celia Sanchez and women in the revolution who became kind of iconic figures. And there are whole groups of people who are doing primary research on their stories and trying to build their biographies. There's the really curious and fascinating presence of Raul's daughter, Mariela Castro, who came to San Francisco, as you must know, to meet and get advice from the LGBT community. And she's gone on a global campaign trying to influence her father on LGBT rights in Cuba. How does that fit in with the theory that societies are frozen and totalitarian under one party? Because they've done a gradual evolution that's remarkably worth studying in comparison with the American LGBT movements and women's movements. And there should be a flood of exchanges and conferences about these subjects, listening to what the Cuban experience has been since the day that they kicked poor Allen Ginsberg out of Cuba because he was ranting and raving about the suppression of gay people there and writing poetry about it and yelling in the streets, which was seen as unusual by the Cubans. But he needs to be resuscitated in Cuba. He wrote an extraordinary little essay about Cuba before he was thrown out. So all of these things now, if the pressure is back, I think you'll see a leap forward in the eagerness of people to take these on. As for young people, who knows? I mean, I think they're sick and tired of the status quo. And it doesn't mean in the least that they want to overthrow their government and bring about catastrophe. But they want to move on. They want to come here. They want you to come there. They want to flourish. They want the internet. The internet is quite interesting because nobody can afford access. And no internet, the CIA thinks, well, that's got to be overcome with secret internet access. We'll promote democracy through secret transmission of internet technology. But the other way to look at it is if you want to be in the front ranks of the fight against Ebola, if you want to be a medical researcher in Cuba, if you want to continue their humanitarian missions, you need the internet to read the medical journals. And everybody knows that. Otherwise, their economic development is stagnating, will stagnating. That's the first thing that Obama and Raul have to settle, is how are you going to deliver open internet to whom at what price in Cuba, and Cuba's going to have to deal with the open society implications of that. But it'll come from within because they need the internet. Not to pretend that they're little Tom Paines going around trying to incite people, but because they have to know how to make sick people well. They have to know the latest about energy technology. They have to have access to journals and so on. I think that will happen. And there's a appropriation for democracy programs that's pending. You're the person to get on, because she's really on your side on this, is Barbara Lee. And go to Nancy Pelosi. Because Barbara Lee's been down there. Ask her how many times. I don't want to reveal it, because she doesn't want to be away from her constituency that much. But ask her how many times.
It's a pretty safe district.
And but she's been in the forefront of this as a woman, as an African-American, as a member of Congress, as a peace activist. And she needs to make sure that line item is money for cultural exchange and not money for secret exchanges of technology in the dead of night on street corners in some rural community in Cuba. If she raises a fuss, and she knows how to raise a fuss, she can make that process of exchange more democratic and more open and get rid of the covert, sinister characteristics that have been the mark of the past.
I want to go off of that point and ask your opinion about something. One, you mentioned before that sometimes these things that we do have unintended consequences.
They sure do.
And sometimes they're bad, but sometimes they might, in ways you didn't expect, produce interesting results that might also be positive. One of the things you observe about Cuba in cities where people are still driving automobiles, if they're driving cars from the 1950s, and you've created, I wouldn't call it a cultural imperative, but sort of a work ethic that says, if we can't import the parts, we'll just figure out how to fix the car. A spirit, if you like, of self-sufficiency and entrepreneurship, if you like, that is an unintended consequence of this embargo. Is it possible that by normalizing relationships, you might have the unintended consequence of diminishing that there? It's a positive thing to have that.
I'm sure that the slaves were extremely good at fixing plantation technology.
Yeah.
That's a problem for the Cubans to deal with. That's not our mandate. I'm sorry. They are extremely uncannily clever about repair, fixing, resurfacing, and so on.
Well, I ask that because you described before the hardship that they lived under, but many of them had learned to cope, is what I'm trying to say.
They know how to cope with the best of them on Earth. They really do. One of the things that might be a fruitful exchange is, since the island has all kinds of renewable energy, is it possible to put those beautiful old cars in a proper setting and introduce a completely zero-emission transportation system in Cuba? That would be a model for the third world that would be very, very... And I'm sure they need the capital. They have the brains. They have the technicians. Who's going to make the car is the question. Could it be Fiat, somebody that's a non-U.S. manufacturer? Could it be Chevy? All these things are on the drawing boards now that were unthinkable 6 months ago, and who knows? But I don't think they envision a future of getting fat at McDonald's and driving gas-guzzling cars. I don't think so.
Okay, back to a question from the audience and staying on this theme about listening to each other, both countries. One of our audience members tonight said, how can we expect them to learn from our civil rights movement when we haven't achieved racial equality at all? And another writes, for our civil rights movement, what can we learn from the example of the revolution in Cuba?
Well, going backwards, the revolution in, there's a long chapter here about the beginning. The revolution in Cuba came at the same time as the African liberation movements and the American civil rights movement, and there were a lot of people from the Caribbean in the forefront of the American civil rights movement, like Stokely Carmichael. You know, Cuba had been the slave mart of the Caribbean, and the anti-slavery struggles in Cuba and here are really brilliantly told in Gerald Horne's history, Race to Revolution, that you should read, H-O-R-N-E. When Fidel went to Harlem the first time, he met with the young Leroy Jones and poets from Harlem, and he made a point of moving into a hotel in the black community and met with Malcolm X. And there was this love affair, and then it started to be noticed on both sides that the Cuban Revolution had a racial gap. And it was partly due to a class analysis that thought that a race analysis would interfere with the unity of the nation against Yankee imperialism. So discussion of race as an autonomous subject or creating a black power movement in Cuba was seen as a threat to the integrity and unity of the revolution. And for whatever reason, there was a long, long process before it became apparent that something had to be done about this on its own terms. And again, with the pressure lifted, the threat lifted, their internal issues are going to come to the fore and be dealt with. And there'll be sharp disagreements about what to do. But in the debates in Cuba about affirmative action, we're not a model of anything, but they obviously, naturally, are going to turn to their American friends and ask, what happened? Do you have any advice? That's all I meant by that. We're not going to be able to offer more. But I do think Obama will be the most popular person in Cuba pretty soon, even though they'll be wondering what he really means and what's in that budget. But it's just an awesome thing for them. 40-50% of the country is Afro-Cuban. And here's an American president with his family coming down there and giving talks to students. I'd love to be a fly on the wall. I don't know what's going to happen. And you can say, oh, it's an imperialist trick. They've seen so many imperialist tricks. You know, they're going to just welcome, and what do you have to say for yourself? That's what they'll want to know, and he better come prepared. With his, remember, he's an anti-colonial Marxist from Southeast Asia, isn't he? You know, he does have a background that he can share with them.
Okay, one of our other audience members tonight, sort of thinking outside Cuba a little bit, think outside the box, said, can you please comment on contrasting normalization of U.S. relations with Cuba with the same thing maybe with North Korea?
North Korea over my pay grade. A distinction should be made. I started saying normalization, but it's not normalization. It's diplomatic recognition on a path to normalization, because the Cubans feel you can't have normalization while they're on a list of state-sponsored terrorism, because you don't have normal relationships with terrorist countries. So they make a distinction there. I think Obama understands this and has given the indication that he will remove them. That's not been done, and they won't start talking about normalization until that's done. But there's no going back from diplomatic recognition and from the steps that I discussed earlier. On North Korea, um, I'd ask the Cubans if they have any thoughts on the subject.
I think
you know, Alarcón is one of these people. He knows more important people in the world than anyone else in the world. He was a diplomat when he was like 21 years old. So he's been privy to revolutionary discussions, state secrets, UN Security Council meetings. He chaired the Security Council. And his head must be exploding with things that he can't say. And he's embargoed until now. He's embargoed from coming here. You know, you can't talk to him. And as a diplomat, he's under certain obligations not to share everything that he knows, but there's a world to learn there in as this starts to thaw and open up. And I'm sure, I wasn't kidding, I'm sure he has information about North Korea that we don't have.
He'd be helpful.
Might be, might not. He might say, impossible, I have no idea. No idea what he thinks, I never asked him.
All right, we're inside 2 minutes before we conclude. So I'm going to end this with our last question from the audience. Personal question to you, a little revolutionary. And the audience member writes, what is the status of your political anger today? How do you see the future? Any hopefulness?
I'm just as angry. Or was it anchor? What was the...
Well, it looked like
anger. My political anger or my political anchor?
What are you passionate about today?
I recognize that, you know, my time that remaining to me is truly limited, and it's not in my hands. So I try to think carefully about what I can do that would be relevant and helpful based on my experience. I leave everything else to others who I look to for guidance. But I have a special interest in going as far as possible with the California clean energy programs and building California as a model for the International Conference on Dealing with Climate Change. So I work a lot with the governor's office, the Energy Commission, the Air Board, Senator De Leon, and California environmentalists. And I mean, I work a lot, like 3-4 hours a day. Every day. The 50th anniversary of the first protest of the Vietnam War is coming up May 2nd. We are now in the 50th anniversary of the first teach-in at Berkeley and the first teach-in in Ann Arbor and the first demonstration called by SDS in April of that year. And so I'm part of a steering committee that's trying to bring 1,000 people to Washington for the same purpose, to say, what did we do? What did we leave behind? What's our legacy? It's interesting to me that the peace movement comes and goes. Nothing could be more important, since we're in an age of permanent war, than having a permanent peace movement. But we don't have an NAACP, I'm sorry. We don't have a National Organization of Women. We don't have a AFL-CIO, the equivalent organizational base for a peace movement. What we have is a legacy and an instinct among people to smell a lie when the odor is strong enough and to go out on the street with a placard or to write their congressperson or back Barbara Lee when they see a war coming that they think is unexplainable, unwinnable, and unaffordable. And we have to count on them, but it's sort of shocking to me that each new war, you have to look for a new well-funded organization. It's just not there. The environmental organizations have 10 groups that have millions of dollars in budgets. So that's an obsession of mine that I want to deal with in the coming years, starting with this conference. You can go online and you'll find we've had some successful efforts so far. And I'm very interested in the LGBT movement. I'm very interested in the living wage movement, the Black Lives Matter and the Ferguson movements. I see in especially the Ferguson, the young people are identical. I was talking to an old SNCC person last night. They're identical to the Freedom Rides. We now think from the movies that the Freedom Rides were called. I was a Freedom Rider. They were called by a commander, and we all boarded buses and went forth. But they grew out of the sit-ins, which grew out of four people taking a chance, and then four other people, and then suddenly 40,000 people were sitting in at lunch counters in the South and blocking the system of segregation, and it was utterly unorganized except for the organization of the ghosts. The past was speaking. The elders were speaking. And so I'm interested in trying to be an elder to those movements without getting directly involved. And in my spare time, I write. And I have a 15-year-old. I have obligations. I have to take him to school tomorrow morning. So that's about it. That's all I can handle.
Well, our special thanks to Tom Hayden. Tom, thank you for being with us and talking about, with us tonight.
One thing, yeah, about the immigrant rights movement. Do not separate these domestic from international movements. The one importance of Cuba is that Cuban immigrants have been reactionaries politically for so long, but now that's all turning around. They're joining the immigrant rights cause, and you've got 5 million people that are at least gaining the right to a livelihood and protection from deportation. They will be including the Cuban diaspora. So there's a meeting of Latin America and of the immigrant rights movement here that is the key to the future of California and to the next majority in the United States will be Latino immigrants, Asian immigrants, young people, yeah, and Cubans will be very much in that mix. It's a completion of the cycle for two apparently different movements, which are actually one movement.
Well, thank you. Again, our thanks to Tom for his life and his work and his new book, Listen Yankee, Why Cuba Matters. We also want to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and internet. For now, I'm Joe Tooman, and this is meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.